When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Welcome to another podcast at SlicedOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. Joining us now, John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation. Well, it's been an interesting, kind of quiet week, but there's a couple things. I really had to pan for some gold today, John, to talk about things. It was, whew, had a really look.
Yeah, you know, you got to look a little bit, but I don't know. You know, you tell me, because this is just a theory on my part, but if the former FBI director writes a book in which he details how the sitting president of the United States was all over him about trying to discredit potential tapes showing the current president of the United States with prostitutes in some sort of surreally compromising circumstances in Russia, because, according to the book, there would be real trouble if Trump's wife found out about it. I thought that's the most amazing thing, that, like, Trump is saying, you got to go after this thing, because if there's a 1% chance that my wife finds out about this, I'm in real trouble.
Let's start out with a very important newsmaker, Stephen Colbert. This broke right before he went on his show last night, and here's how he started his show.
Just before I came out here, James Comey news broke. Apparently, in Comey's new book, Comey reveals that while he was still in office, President Trump asked him to investigate the P tape to reassure Melania. According to Comey, he brought up what he called the golden showers thing, adding that it bothered him if there was even a 1% chance his wife Melania thought it was true. Yes, it would bother him, because she'd be off by about 99%. In the book, Comey wonders why Trump would need to give his wife that kind of reassurance, claiming there is zero chance Comey's own wife would believe such a claim. Oh, come on, sanctimonious much, James Comey? Not everyone's lucky enough to be in one of those rare fairy tale marriages with a 100% no hooker PP guarantee.
I mean, like, you gotta give Colbert credit. He went to the heart of the matter. Because the truth is, when you read everything about this book, and there's a lot of stuff. I mean, I haven't read the whole book, but seen a lot of the extracts, a lot of the assessments of it. When you read everything about this book, you know, the list is pretty endless there.
Well, before you go any further, let's just, this is this morning on ABC Good Morning America, George Stephanopoulos, who is doing an hour interview with Comey this Sunday night. Here's some excerpts.
January 6, 2017, Trump Tower. FBI Director James Comey set to meet President-elect Donald Trump for the first time.
As you headed into Trump Tower that day, were you nervous?
Yes.
Comey was with a group of intelligence agency heads, briefing Trump and his top aides on how the Russians interfered in our election.
President-elect Trump's first question was to confirm that it had no impact on the election. And then the conversation, to my surprise, moved into a PR conversation about how the Trump team would position this and what they could say about this. They actually started talking about drafting a press release with us still sitting there. And the reason that was so striking to me is that that's just not done. That the intelligence community does intelligence, the White House does PR and spin.
You also said you were struck by what they didn't ask.
Very much. No one, to my recollection, asked, so what's coming next from the Russians? How might we stop it? What's the future look like? It was all, what can we say about what they did and how it affects the election that we just had?
Comey then asked to meet alone with Trump to warn him about that now infamous Steele dossier, unverified information on Trump's ties to Russia, including allegations of Trump's encounters with prostitutes in Moscow.
I'm about to meet with a person who doesn't know me, has just been elected president of the United States by all accounts, and from my watching him during the campaign, could be volatile. And I'm about to talk to him about allegations that he was involved with prostitutes in Moscow and that the Russians taped it and have leverage over him.
Was there any choice there? why, if this was salacious, and this particular part of the dossier unverified, still unverified, by the way?
Yes. So far as when I got fired, it was unverified.
Did you tell him that the Steele dossier had been financed by his political opponents?
No. I didn't even think I used the term Steele dossier. I just talked about additional material.
But did he have a right to know that?
That it had been financed by his political opponents? I don't know the answer to that. It wasn't necessary for my goal, which was to alert him that we had this information.
How graphic did you get?
I think as graphic as I needed to be. I started to tell him about the allegation was that he had been involved with prostitutes in a hotel in Moscow in 2013 during a visit for the Miss Universe pageant, and that the Russians had filmed the episode. And he interrupted very defensively and started talking about it. You know, do I look like a guy who needs hookers? And I assumed he was asking that rhetorically. I didn't answer that, and I just moved on and explained, sir, I'm not saying that we credit this, I'm not saying we believe it. We just thought it very important that you know.
Did you tell him you thought it wasn't true, or you didn't know if it was true or not?
I never said I don't believe it, because I couldn't say one way or another.
How weird was that briefing?
Really weird.
Can you believe this?
The term really, just the really weird, pretty good at the end there, because the way he said it was just about perfect. But then also, you know, in fairness, there's elements of this thing, right? It's a complex situation where he said in the, early on, you know, well, we don't do it that way. We don't do things like that. So it was very odd that Trump started talking about PR with the FBI. And I do think that this goes to one of the key elements here, one of the truly weird things about it. Donald Trump was so unprepared to be president of the United States that I genuinely believe this, that he didn't understand that the FBI is not the equivalent of Trump Tower security, right? That, like, somebody from his security operation at Trump Tower might come to meet with Donald Trump and say, hey, we're hearing about this stuff, or hey, there's this stuff or that stuff. And he didn't understand that this is a fully different relationship. And my sense is that I think it took, I don't, I'm, in some ways, I'm not sure Trump understands it to this day.
Well,
no, I'm not kidding. You know, I'm saying, I know it sounds bizarre. Didn't, I'm not kidding.
Evidently, University of Pennsylvania or the Wharton School of Business, did they have no civics classes?
Well, in the high school and office stuff like this. I mean, or maybe Sly, simply paying attention to, I don't know, the news over the last, you know, 70 years.
Well, what was he doing during Watergate?
But we know that, right? We have the answer. Early stages of Watergate, he was avoiding service in the Vietnam War. Later stages, you know, partying in New York. But, no, this is, it's a very, I think that's actually a very telling set of insights there, because, you know, beneath all that is a real clear understanding that Trump didn't understand the relationship he was in. And also, I mean, you know, Comey says, in other places, you know, every time they met with Trump, or when he would go meet with Trump, he would quickly go and make notes. That's a classic field agent thing. You know, you note down what was said in the conversation, do it quickly enough, so you actually can get pretty accurate quotes. You know what I mean? You remember the details. You don't let time cause a fade.
Right down to the details of the size of his hands and the spray tan that he has.
There you have it. But I think that's significant, because I'm sure that Trump didn't understand that while he wasn't being recorded in those conversations, that when he was talking to Comey, those people, you know, that was going to be noted. It would go into a record. And so this is a guy who was certainly ill-served by his own lack of preparation, but he was also incredibly ill-served. And I'll point a finger of blame at somebody here. By Jared Kushner, because from the mid-stage of the campaign right up into the transition process, Jared Kushner did everything he could to push Chris Christie out of the process. And you understand that as a former federal prosecutor, Chris Christie was in the position Trump had wanted him in, which is overseeing the transition. Chris Christie very probably would have been in that room, or at least very, you know, in the proximity there. And my bet is that Christie might well have dialed a lot of this down, changed the direction of things, and, you know, had a...
Shoulda, woulda, coulda. Shoulda, woulda, coulda. Yep. All right, so while this is all going on, we have incredible stories coming out from the Washington Post that, in fact, Michael Cohen allegedly liked to record phone calls, play them back for Trump, and they would laugh on how they had the ability to strong-arm someone. And so there's panic in the White House right now that these tapes exist and that the FBI has them. Well, last night, Michael Avenatti, who is one of my heroes now, I'm just going to...
I love this guy.
This dude... rocks. All right. So Michael Avenatti, who's Stormy Daniels' attorney, he was on Lawrence O'Donnell's show last night, and they were having fun. Here's Avenatti.
Lawrence, if you thought the pucker factor was significant on Monday night after the raids, that's nothing compared to the pucker factor that is present tonight in light of this Washington Post story. If this Washington Post story is true, that there are actual tapes of Michael Cohen communicating with opponents, potentially leaning on folks, threatening them, that he then played because he was proud of them, potentially tapes between him and Mr. Trump. I don't even know how to describe that. It's so shocking. It makes the Nixon tapes look like a church picnic, potentially. You know, I'll say this. A lot of people, when we first started this, started comparing this to Watergate and said this is going to be similar to Watergate. And I didn't agree with that. I thought it was overblown. I think we're beyond potentially Watergate at this point.
So true, isn't it?
Well, you know, that's the funny thing. Watergate was bad. I mean, there's no question. Cancer on the presidency. But at least Nixon... Every evidence is that, you know, kind of Nixon was a relatively rational guy who was a bad player, but did know how to at least play within some of the rules. I would agree. I think there's a lot of evidence here that Trump is way beyond, Trump with people around him, way beyond where Nixon is. And one final element here, Nixon still had within at least some elements of the establishment, the state, if you will, people that were sympathetic to him or aligned with him. I have a feeling that Trump's got almost nobody here who thinks he's a good player.
He is operating with Fox. He's tweeting out, watch Sean Hannity. People turn on Sean Hannity, and you've got Sean Hannity calling Robert Mueller a mob boss and then drawing these diagrams with all these other people. But more importantly, the person that Donald Trump ended up not hiring, this Joe DeGeneva, who he was on Fox, and he's basically sending instructions via television.
Yep.
Rod Rosenstein is so incompetent, compromised, and conflicted that he can no longer serve as the Deputy Attorney General. And Jeff Sessions now has an obligation to the President of the United States to fire Rod Rosenstein after Rosenstein authorized the unconstitutional and unprofessional search of the office of Michael Cohen in New York. Jeff Sessions, tomorrow morning, should fire Rod Rosenstein.
I feel like we're in the middle of a slow motion movie that's acting out.
Yeah.
Doesn't it feel that way?
No, I think you're really, really, really right about that. because, you know, what's happened, and this is not just a function of Trump or the Trump moment, it's a function of the changing media of the United States. And this stuff all happens in real time now, right? You know, what might in the past have had, you know, some public moments, but also, you know, things that private, things that we won't learn for years to come. Most of this is right out front. Partially that does extend from Trump because he likes to do things on the surface, but also he's responsive to media outlets and individuals that he's close to or that he's aligned with. But the other thing is, yeah, you know, we're in an era of social media, 24-hour cable, all this stuff. And so I do think things that when we look back 10 years from now at this moment were really big deals weren't played out behind the scenes. They were played out in, you know, on TV screens with the president then tweeting his responses.
We'll take a break. We'll talk about the retirements of Congressman Paul Ryan next at SliceOffice.com with John Nichols.
Injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh.
When you hire a lawyer to help you with your personal injury, you want to know that you'll have that lawyer's personal attention. With John and I, that's exactly what you'll get. With many firms, the lawyer that you see in the ad is not the lawyer who is going to be representing you in the case.
One of the differences with Mike and my practice is that when you hire us, you'll have us personally involved in your case.
Call injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh at 257-5661 for the personal attention you deserve.
We're back at SliceOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation with us. So after 20 years, the boy wonder for Wall Street and the Heritage Foundation is calling it quits. Let me just play a little bit of the coverage from CBS.
Mr. Speaker, why are
Paul
you...
Paul Ryan will walk away from the most powerful job on Capitol Hill after just 3 years.
I will be setting new priorities in my life.
He gave three reasons for his departure. They are 16, 14, and 13, and they're in Wisconsin. All of them born since he came to Congress in 1999.
My dad died when I was 16, the age my daughter is. And I just don't want to be one of those people looking back at my life thinking I spent more time with my kids when I know if I spend another term, they will only know me as a weekend father.
Thank you.
Ryan was drafted to be speaker in 2015 after conservatives forced out John Boehner. As recently as January, the 48-year-old Ryan insisted he was staying put.
I have no plans of going anywhere anytime soon.
Today, he claimed the daunting midterm elections and an unpredictable president had nothing to do with his choice. But Ryan is the 24th House Republican to retire this term.
All right. Your thoughts on this?
Since Paul Ryan said he's, you know, wants to be with his kids, which I think I'm sure he loves his kids, I'm sure he cares about them, that would mean he's going to be moving back to Janesville, right?
You can be with your kids in more than one place in Janesville.
Yeah, but what's Paul Ryan going to do in Janesville?
Well, right. Oh, go work for the Parker Penn Foundation, or maybe he could go to work for General Motors. Oh, wait a minute. Beloit Corporation, maybe. No, that's
down
gone.
Road,
Lear? No, that's gone. Huh.
I'm kind of serious. I mean, if he's really...
Well, I was just trying to paint the picture of what happened to Janesville during his tenure.
What has been lost, yeah. But I'm serious about this. You know, if that's his desire, then presumably he won't be a lobbyist, right? And, you know, he won't be, like, working with Wall Street folks and doing all that stuff like that. He'll be back in Janesville. And I can't figure out exactly what he's going to do if he's sincere about this, which leads me, and I don't want to be a cynic about this, to suspect that whole thing about the midterm elections and Trump and all that, I don't know if he's, and boy, I'm really hard-pressed on this one, but I'm not sure he's telling the truth.
John Harrison Nichols.
You know, I know it's I'm just a little torn on this because you realize that, you know, Paul Ryan's dad went to law school with my dad and, you know, certainly have followed him every step of his career and seen everything he's done. And it just seems to me like the ultimate political career, the most ambitious and determined political player I have seen, a guy who makes, you know, a lot of these other people that we talk about as, you know, like kind of hard-charging politicians look like comedy. A guy who positioned himself, you know, throughout his career to be in power places within his party, to be the vice presidential nominee, Speaker of the House, of course, every time saying, oh, really, me? That suddenly this very manipulative, incredibly ambitious political player would realize, okay, I got to get out of Washington right now. You know, my sense is it has to do with three factors. Number one, the broader reality of the midterms, a really serious issue for him. Number two, the fact that those midterms could go bad for him. And number three, the unsettling prospect that one of the reasons the midterms could go bad, could go even worse than he anticipated, is because he knows something that you and I don't know. i.e. something about Donald Trump.
Well, now there you go.
Now, that would be the cynical sense
of this thing. Well, you know, with the advent of computers in the internet age, he could certainly be some sort of consultant or work for some think tank and live in Wisconsin, but, you know, fly back and forth to Washington. But nonetheless.
Yeah, well, that's my thing.
Yeah.
You know, I have this weird sense of the possibility that Paul Ryan, you know, he might not be devoting all of his time to hanging out in Janesville.
You know, it's interesting. He's not a lawyer.
He's not. No. Most of the things where you might make a buck,
right,
aren't there. And
although you know, although Scott Klug sort of set up. Scott Klug's not a lawyer, and he sort of got hooked in with this division at Foley and Lardner, where he hustled business for them. I think probably still does. Used to be Lee Dreyfus, Marty Schreiber. They went to work for big insurance companies, right? They all moved up to Stevens Point and went to work for big insurance companies. And, of course, Tony Earle went and worked for Quarles and Brady, which is a big firm.
No, but Tony was a lawyer.
Right. You know, I mean, Tony's a lawyer, right?
And
Marty Schreiber's a lawyer. Right, right.
Yeah. So, I mean, but I don't say this. I mean, I don't think we've probably spent too much time thinking about this, except for the seeming transparency of Ryan's, you know, real ambitions or real concerns here.
I don't think we'll ever see him run for office again. I think he's toast. I don't think he has any political legs. He wasn't an effective candidate for vice president.
No. Oh no! But here's the thing for you, though. I do think that he is such a political careerist, such a determined political insider, that there is one possibility as regards this departure that that could be effective, and this is it. If indeed the 2018 campaign proves to be disastrous for Republicans, if, you know, it's just a wipeout, there would be a major effort to share blame if you were the Speaker of the House and maybe you got beat for your own seat, or at least you got swept out as Speaker of the House. You'd be a part of that very tragic storyline, right? If you pull yourself out, if you step down in April, you're just a spectator, right? Oh, wow, a bunch of bad
Look
stuff
at that
happened.
What happened?
And that's a much better place to be than the morning after a wipeout disastrous election, having to go before the cameras and explaining, you know, you're a part in it.
You know, for years he was able to float along. It's Mr. Congenial, Mr. Frat Boy, clean cuts, you know, was socially nice to Democrats, so people kind of floated along. You know, the worst thing that ever happened to him was sunlight, and when Mitt Romney picked him to run, and he told the American people things that weren't true, and performed poorly in the debates against a more seasoned Vice President Joe Biden.
He's basically
right. He performed very poorly, and then his other moment in the sun as Speaker. Let's face it, he's been a complete disaster. He's been nothing more than a water boy, and as you said, he helped get Donald Trump elected. You know,
when this guy's
had his moments, when he's been put in the game, when it's most important, he's failed.
That's right, and I mean, he's failed as you know what he's billed as, the smartest guy in the room. He's obviously, there's pretty good evidence he hasn't been that. But he also failed on a moral conscience measure. And part of his nice guy persona was this sense that, you know, I mean, he's very conservative. That's cool. That's fine. But did he do the right thing at critical stages? That's the presumption that extends from being, you know, hail fellow well met, right? And yet we must remember the critical moment in Donald Trump's presidential campaign as regards Paul Ryan. There are many of them, right? But the one that really stands out is when Paul Ryan referred to what Donald Trump was saying about a Hispanic judge, a federal judge who was born in the U.S., but Trump was saying horrible, clearly racist things about him. Paul Ryan referred to that as textbook racism, textbook bigotry, right? And yet then he turned around and said, yeah, but of course, if Trump's the nominee, I'll back him. You know, things like that
right.
were what legitimized Donald Trump with mainstream Republicans.
Well,
Paul Ryan made Trump possible with statements like that.
Let me ask you about what happens to the first congressional district. This is a district that's been gerrymandered for in its eternity. Beloit was always part of the district. When Beloit was removed and they added the southern third of Waukesha County, a good, you know, it's probably one of the few parts of the district that has a growing population. And far southern Milwaukee County is not Democratic. No. When they added that portion to the district, it became reliably Republican. Now, Rebecca Dallet flipped two congressional districts to the progressive side in this past spring election. She did not turn the first congressional district to the progressive side, although she was very competitive.
Right. I mean, she closed a lot of the gap. She flipped Kenosha County back quite substantially, and that's a big deal. I think that it's fair to say that the first congressional district can be competitive. It's not guaranteed that it will be. I think it certainly would have been competitive with Ryan there, because there's an anger at Ryan, certainly among independent voters, Democrats, liberals, progressives, moderates. But there's also even some conservatives that don't like the guy. And so you end up in a situation where he was uniquely vulnerable. The question is, will a Republican candidate potentially positioned as somebody without as much baggage, will that candidate be able to kind of maximize the advantages of gerrymandering? And that comes up against two factors. Number one, the whole kind of roller coaster ride that they've been on right now. And the district is in a bit of political chaos because of Ryan stepping down. That might harm a Republican. Republican could be harmed by a multi-candidate primary as well. The other factor is, if this is a wave election year, if you really have a big Democratic turnout and people really coming with enthusiasm to back Democratic candidates, that district could well be competitive. Because one thing about the Dallet campaign is, she was running as first-time statewide candidate. She really ran well, and she did a tremendous amount of, you know, outstate campaign. No question of that. But she didn't do a lot of hand-holding in rural Rock and Lulworth and Western Racine and Kenosha County. If there was a smart Democratic candidate nominee who really did focus in on those traditionally Republican areas and tried to at least get up to Obama 2012 levels of votes, you could, you know, it's very much within the realm of reason that a Democrat could not just be competitive, but even take the race. But all of those things, you have to put all those pieces in place. And that long list of things that I just ran through, without that, the Republican would have an advantage.
And some of this is going to depend on who comes out of the primaries. There's going to be competitive primaries on both sides now. It looks like former Congressman Peter Barca, who's in the state assembly now, very well may be running again. Kathy Myers, Randy Bryce on the Democratic side. And then on the Republican side, you talk about a free-for-all.
Potentially. And, you know, why not? Because as you point out initially, this is a gerrymandered district, one of the few places in the country where a Republican who runs a good campaign might still be able to make it politically. And the district is literally packed with Republicans. They have a massive bench there. And you've got a lot of legislators coming, you know, out of the middle of that district. Democrats tend to represent the eastern and western ends. You also have people with ties to Ryan. yeah, very close ties to Ryan, as well as people with strong constituencies and bases within the district. So theoretically, not certainly, you could have a multi-candidate primary on the Republican side with a substantial group of people who have money. And remember, there will almost certainly be a candidate tied to Ryan running, but that might not be the break that Republicans need. They might actually be better off with a candidate who, you know, can run with a measure of independence from the crisis that we're in.
One thing to mention, and this is kind of insider-ish, but it makes a big difference when it comes to money. That congressional district has four media markets. It has Milwaukee, Madison, Chicago, and Rockford.
Yes, it does. And it's massively expensive. You need, you know, probably $5-6 million to begin to do your basic media campaign in a year, which TV is going to be full of ads anyway. You also have another factor there, Sly. There are distinct political cultures in that district.
Oh, my God, there's about five of them.
That's right. Anybody who tells you Kenosha's got the same political culture as Racine.
Oh, two different worlds.
They are. And Janesville in the West, a very different political culture. You actually have areas of rural or relatively rural, small town Democrats up in the West and the northwestern part of that district. You've got some of the most classic Republican suburbs in Wisconsin. You know,
sure.
Literally Ring of Fire.
Mequonago, New Berlin. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you have
real old school Wisconsin farm country in parts of that district, right? In the middle of it. And so, you know, even doing a media campaign, let's say you've got the 5 or 6 million to get on all the four markets, there are very different messages that work in these different places.
Yeah, even within counties in that district, you have completely bifurcated.
Western Virginia versus the city.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
Tell me Kenosha versus Wilmot. You tell me.
Right. Yeah. No, it is really an interesting thing. Journalists are going to love covering it. John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation, thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com.
Pleasure, brother.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
Making stuff matters, because when we make things in America, America makes it. American workers and families make it. Our communities make it. Consider this. For every one manufacturing job in our communities, 5 more jobs are supported. Manufacturing jobs pay an average of 10 to 50% more than service sector jobs. That allows working families to support their local businesses, schools, emergency services, and more. Creating 2.5 million new manufacturing jobs would mean at least $100 billion for our economy over the next decade. Domestic manufacturing is the green economy. It's among the cleanest, most efficient, and productive in the world. That's why the United Steelworkers and our more than 1 million members and retirees are fighting so hard to protect and grow manufacturing. Because making stuff really does matter. Join our fight. Visit usw.org and like us at facebook.com/steelworkers. Support American manufacturing. Buy American. Buy Union.